This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about federal employees, of course, but those that might be very close to retirement, and maybe even those very close to the beginning of their career. And here to talk about that with me is Tammy Flanagan, the knower of all things federal, Social Security, Senior Benefit Director, Weekly GovExec columnist. I don't know when she sleeps. Good morning, Tammy.
Good morning, Bob.
And our ever-efficient engineer, Dorothy. Why don't you give Dorothy a call? Or us a call, 202-465-3080. My name is Bob Lines. I'm an accountant finance type. And when we talk about, I guess, the glide path to retirement, you gave me something this morning before the show, and it says retirement planning from day one. So we'll get to the closer to in a second, but I like that. And it, of course, was from one of your GovExec articles. How do you start planning day one? You don't even know what kind of job you're in.
Well, I think the attitude about planning for retirement is changing over the years, because I have an uncle who retired 1978 civil service retirement. And I asked him, I said, Uncle Steve, what did you do to prepare for your retirement? I said, did you attend a seminar? Did you, hire a financial planner? How did you plan? And he said, I turned 55 and I retired. He says, there really wasn't any planning involved. You go down to personnel and sit down, fill out the forms, and off you go. But I think today, because we have the savings plan, we have the thrift savings plan, and we have to coordinate that with qualifying for Social Security, and you have a basic retirement benefit. And I think there's more planning involved. So I think new employees would be wise to set some goals early on, even in the very beginning of their career, what their plans are and how long they would like to work. And you can always change them along the way. But in having that goal set to say that I want to retire at 57 or at 65 or whatever age you're thinking of, then you can start to figure out how much you need to save to supplement your other benefits. And if you decide to change gears and move into private industry and back into federal government, you can understand what you're doing and what impact it's going to have on your benefits if you start that planning early on. So I do think it's important to have new employee orientations now that does include a pretty lengthy segment on benefits and financial planning.
Absolutely, especially FERS, not to create a class war, but with FERS, they have to be real about retirement dollars. Well, what are they going to need and how are they going to get there?
Right.
I think thanks to all your good articles and calculations, one can rough out what the base FERS annuity would be, but that's only part of it.
Right.
Social Security is going to be what it is, or Social Security is going to be what it isn't, and then the fine-tuning of the TSP.
And the fact that not every employee that comes into federal government these days makes it their lifelong career. So if you're leaving the government to move into private industry, you have to realize you may not have a pension. You may not have a basic benefit, so your savings will become more important. And the fact that both FERS and private sector plans are based on Social Security. And I know, a lot of people are uncertain about the future of Social Security, but even the way it is right now, it's a tilted system. So if you make a lot of money, you're not going to get much replacement in the form of your Social Security benefit, even if nothing changes. Whereas somebody who makes lower wages will get a little higher replacement because of how that system sort of has, as some people call it, a welfare tilt to it, that it provides more to those who earn less and a little less to those who earn more, with the theory being that if you make more money, you should be able to save more.
So that's right. And it was always designed that way. So this is nothing,
nothing
recent
new.
Change.
That's right.
Well, and to be fair, it probably makes some sense.
Well, it is. Yeah. That's why they call it social insurance. It's our form of socialism in this government system.
Yeah.
As much as you want to admit or not admit that, that's how it's designed.
All righty. So beginning, mid, very important, but the I guess the heart of today's show is the retirement process. And when should one, you should be serious about this early on, but when do you get real serious?
Yeah, when it's time to set the date, when you're really, zeroing in on a specific date to retire, That's when you want to get, you know, that last annuity estimate from your benefits office. That's when you want to check on Social Security if you're old enough to collect and start thinking about what you want to do with your TSP. I'd say, you know, within that 5-year range before retirement, you're starting to set those specific goals, you know, starting that countdown of, you know, 5 years to go, 4 years and so forth. But then when you're within a year of retirement, then you really want to start looking at the application because you have to apply for civil service or FERS retirement. You want to check out the Social Security website and find out what's involved if you apply for Social Security early or if you wait a little bit longer, if you're going to work after you retire. Those are some things to consider. And then when it comes to TSP, if you are going to work after retirement, your choice may be not to withdraw your TSP. You might want to let it set and earn a little more interest and grow some more, or maybe move it to an IRA and do something else with it. So you're starting to make those kinds of decisions, which is, I think, where the retirement seminars that we provide come in handy, because it kind of gives you some ideas of how to make those plans and how to prepare. But then when it's time to actually file the form and set the date, most agencies would like you to give them 60 to 90 days notice that you're leaving. And that's not so much so that they can plan for your replacement, but that's so that you can give your human resource office, the people who are going to handle your transition to retirement, the time to get everything ready to for you to walk out the door and have a smooth transition to retirement. So when someone says, how soon should I put in my application? If you work at one of the larger agencies, I'd say give them at least 60 days notice, maybe better yet, 90. If you work at a small organization where you don't have that many people retiring from one month to the next, then sometimes 30 days is enough. And I've always known that there are people, and I've had it happen when I was a benefit specialist, who will call in Monday morning and say Friday was my last day, and they gave no notice, and they still, you know, somehow managed to get their check. But to make it a smoother transition and to have time to make adjustments at the last minute, you want to give a couple of months notice, I think, is always a good idea.
What's the hardest part of the form filling out process?
I think it's two things. Number one would be setting that specific date. Nobody wants to put that date of final separation in that box. For some reason that gives some people, you know, a little bit of a fearful feeling, because that's commitment. You know, I'm making that commitment. And beyond that, I'd say it's electing what kind of a retirement you want. Do you want a retirement that's just payable during your lifetime, so when you die, it dies with you? Or do you want to take a reduced retirement to provide survivor benefits to your spouse or to someone else who might be financially dependent on you? And I think some people struggle with that decision, because when you do elect a survivor benefit, even if it is for your spouse, it's going to cause a permanent reduction to your retirement. It's fairly expensive. So it causes some people to give some thought to, you know, what choices they have in that area.
When that calculation is made, is the survivor's annuity calculated on the full annuity unreduced by the survivor's election, or is it based on what the annuitant gets?
It's based on the amount that the survivor receives is based on the unreduced annuity.
Okay. So it's the higher number.
Yeah. As a simple example, if your retirement was going to be $40,000 a year, whether it's FERS or SERS, the surviving spouse, if you're providing it for a spouse, would get either 50% of the $40,000 if you're FERS or 55% of the $40,000 if you're CSRS. Although during your lifetime, that $40,000 would get reduced by about 10%, which means you'd only get about $36,000, which also reduces your taxable income. So it's not as expensive as it sounds, because you don't have to pay income tax on that reduction. It's not a withholding.
Right. But the survivor's annuity would be based on the 40.
Right. And as time goes by, you get cost of living adjustments that also increases the base value of that survivor benefit.
Okay. When one elects, I like what you said, that one box, we could fill out the rest, but mm-hmm. we just kind of don't want to. What if we fill out in that box and hand in the paperwork? Is it done, or can we retrieve it and say, 1,000 pardons, I'd like to work another year?
Yeah. Well, retirement is considered a voluntary action. So even up until the day of your final separation, if you get cold feet and change your mind, or for whatever reason decide to withdraw the application, you can generally do that. Now, there are some cases in situations where an employee might accept a buyout or a separation incentive payment, where you'll sign something that says, I am making the commitment to retire, I will leave this day, and there's no turning back. So if you've made that type of a commitment, then it's going to be a lot harder to change your mind. But a normal retirement, you know, you could decide to withdraw it at the last minute. But once you're gone, you know, once that date of separation has gone by, you're off the payroll, it's a little harder to get back. You got to get rehired at that point. But up until the last day, you can still give it a second thought.
Now, I've heard people speak in class, and of course they know I'm not a benefits whiz, but they're concerned about putting the application in maybe a year in advance, that then they wouldn't get a step increase or they wouldn't get some type of raise because they're going to be gone in a year.
Yeah, I guess there's some fear of that, although I'd never recommend putting the application in a year in advance for a couple of reasons. Number one is these forms, believe it or not, are still turned in paper format, which means that forms get revised and, you know, changed over the course of a year. So you might have filled it out and then now you got a new form to fill out next year. Secondly, if I accept your retirement application a year ahead of time, I can't really do anything with it until it's closer to your separation, which means I might forget I even have it, you know, a year later, which defeats the purpose of putting it in early. So that's why I always say I think 60 to 90 days is a good time frame, because less likelihood of it getting put aside or forgotten about by the time you leave, and of course less likelihood of it being amended or updated before you separate. So I think that 60 to 90 days I hopefully won't interfere with any promotions or bonuses you might be entitled to.
Yeah. Okay, the 60 or 90 days too allows the agency then to prepare the proper paperwork to pass along to OPM. Mm-hmm. The incentive there, correct me if I'm wrong, is that then the annuity will catch on quicker for the full annuity. I understand OPM still pays an annuity, but they haven't made all the calculations right away, and especially if they haven't got the agency paperwork.
I think that's what a lot of people misunderstand, because when you're working at FBI or HHS or any of the agencies, they don't have the authority to do the final calculation of your retirement, because this is all administered through the Office of Personnel Management. And OPM can't give you the final calculations until you retire, because they don't have all your final payroll information or personnel information. So it's kind of a catch-22. And employees worry about the fact that they get an estimate from their agency and how accurate is it, and how, you know, what if it's wrong? What if there's a difference? But as long as what went into it's correct, so when you get your estimate back, you look at the dates that they use, you look at the salaries, your birth date, your date of retirement, if all of that is your information, it should be accurate. I mean, there's not a lot of room for judgment in computing a retirement estimate. OPM is going to come up with the same numbers as your agency did, as long as we're using the right amount of service, the right salaries for your high three, and as long as we entered the dates incorrectly as far as your birth date and your retirement date. So I don't think there's as much there to fear if you understand how the calculation is done. Once the claim gets to OPM, usually a couple of weeks after the employee retires, OPM receives your application. They start getting your final payroll information, your final personnel information. Then they can begin to process the retirement. And that process can be delayed for any number of reasons. It can be just volume of retirements happening at that time of the year. It could be there might be an error in some of your service history that doesn't completely document your career, which could cause them to have to go back and request further documentation. It could be the claims examiner who's handling your case is on leave, and maybe it sits on, you know, his or her desk for a couple of weeks longer than it should. So be prepared that when you first retire, those initial payments that you receive from OPM might be considered interim payments or special pay, which means it may not be the full amount you're expecting. It might look a little less generous than what you were hoping for. But know that in a couple of months, hopefully just a few months, you'll get your full annuity in place and you'll start receiving regular monthly payments. So the more you do to understand and prepare ahead of time, hopefully the quicker and less stressful period of time that'll be after you retire, so that there's not going to be those long delays.
Would there ever be any lag time between when somebody retires and when the first annuity check? Does it automatically come the first month after they've retired with that reduced level, or could it take 2 or 3 months?
Well, sometimes it can take a couple of months longer than you expect if there's any question as to your entitlement to retire. If there's anything on that application that leads OPM to believe that you're either not old enough or you don't have enough service to meet the requirements for the type of retirement you're applying for, they won't put you into special pay because you may not have entitlement to even retire. And I'll just say that that's a very rare occurrence. You know, the most people I talk to get their first retirement check as they expected to on time and have good things to say about how the process was and how smoothly it went. But, you know, you do hear from people who experience delays and have problems with the processing, because it is that transition from going from employment to retirement. And I think employees really do need to take an interest in that and make sure they understand what they're doing before they get into it. And I think, you know, getting the estimates ahead of time, attending a retirement seminar, getting a good understanding of where that calculation's coming from will help you understand what you should expect to receive and what should be happening at the time. And I always say, you know, keep copies of everything. You have your own personnel folder, keep copies of the application so that if you ever do need to contact OPM or your payroll office or your human resources office, you have the information in front of you to call from to say, well, this is, you know, what I filled out, or this is the dates of my service, exact date of entry and separation, so that you can talk with some level of knowledge of what you've got.
As one draws closer to the final date, are there any look back provisions? What comes to mind is buying military time, or is it, I won't say it's too late, but somebody would be looking at that saying, well, you know, if I do this, then my base annuity is going to increase, is the investment, and I guess I'm going to have to pay some interest.
Yeah.
Are there any other things like that, or how does that one work?
Ideally, you know, if you do the things we've talked about as far as begin that planning early on in your career, you would know if you owe money to the retirement fund from day one. You know, that would be the ideal thing. But I do run into people who are near retirement or actually have applied for retirement and didn't realize that they had missing contributions, whether it's they owe money for military service, as you mentioned, or they may have worked for the government, but in a temporary position where they didn't have retirement coverage, maybe entry-level work that they'd done. And to get credit for that service, they might find that they have to pay for it. And if 30 years has gone by since that service was performed, you might have to pay for it plus 30 years of interest. So it can be a bit of a shock and quite a large amount of money to have to figure out what to do about. And so you have to make a decision of, is it worth it to pay this deposit or pay this redeposit or military service deposit? And I think the basic answer is going to be how is it going to affect your retirement? If I make a payment of X number of dollars, how will that change the amount of my benefit or when I can retire? And so you have to ask those questions early on to give yourself time to, number one, accumulate the money that you have to pay back, but also to evaluate properly whether or not that's a wise choice to make. Yeah. In most cases, I'd say it is worth paying these deposits that you owe. But there's occasions when you want to look at other options.
Yeah, and just to take it off on a tax tangent, the money that's paid to buy the military time and the interest becomes tax deductible, not all at once, but it goes into the base calculation of what one has had withheld from their salary over the years for, quote, retirement, not the TSP. Plus military buyback time, plus interest, or if there was a deposit, redeposit, and interest, and that's spread out over a proverbial lifetime. So it's spread out over a period of time, but it doesn't go for naught. It isn't just, I'm buying, and I don't
right.
get any benefit.
Yeah, a lot of people think when they pay back the deposit and all the interest that they can deduct it off their tax return that year. But as you're saying, it's not until after you retire that all of the money throughout your entire career that you've contributed towards FERS or CERS retirement, which includes deposits and redeposits and interest on deposits, becomes part of your total contribution. And then I think when you come into the seminar, you explain how you can figure out the yearly or monthly portion of that that's tax-free.
Right, and I also drill down into if you have made deposits like this, you want to make sure that they're accounted for. Not that they're not. I mean, OPM does an outstanding job, but, you know, people say, how would I know? And I said, well, there's only one way to know, and that's write OPM currently, or some agencies, as I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, have the ability to get it online, but not all. Is that true?
Well, most employees have worked long enough now. A lot of employees have worked long enough that they've actually worked under different payroll systems. You know, anybody who has 20 or 30 years of government service had their payroll done pretty much manually back when they were first hired, and now it's converted to an electronic payroll system. And if you've changed agencies, your one agency had their own payroll system, you went to a new agency under a new system. So throughout your career, you may have worked under four or five different payroll systems, and each of those have maintained records of that particular appointment. So if you've done a good job of saving your last leave and earnings statement from every time that payroll system changed, your leave and earnings statement generally shows your accumulated retirement contributions, and it might even show a military deposit if you've paid it. If you've paid a civilian service deposit, you would have paid that directly to OPM, but you would have received a receipt or a statement showing how much you paid. So I always credit the people who are paper savers because they would have those records. They wouldn't have to write or call anybody because they would have maintained it themselves. But like you said, you know, not everybody does such a good job of keeping that, so you're going to rely on either OPM to summarize that when you retire and hope for the best. And usually, like you said, it's accurate. Or if you're in your career still and you're not ready to retire, you could write to OPM or check with your HR office and see if they can connect with OPM and get that information for you. But most people just wait till they retire and get the summary from OPM. They'll tell them, here's your total contribution, and hopefully it's accurate.
Like you say, when we talk about this in class, and I go, you know, if you really want to know, and they go, well, I'll just look at my last leave and earnings statement. And I go, well, that's not going to give it
that's
to you.
It's only for this appointment.
And a few of them get mad, but usually more than a few know. And they go, no, he's right, because when you've changed agencies or systems, the money goes to OPM, and it's like an odometer on a car. That box gets set back to zero. Mm-hmm. So this is just an accumulation since the last change.
Yeah, and the only thing that information is used for is what you're talking about, is to be able to compute the, I guess, tax-free portion of your retirement. So it's not used to compute your retirement. It's not used to determine how much credit for service you receive, but it is going to come in handy when you file your first tax return and everyone thereafter. Because how long does that money normally last as far as giving you a tax-free benefit?
It could between 33 years and 20.
Yeah. So
and the older you are at retirement, the shorter the recovery period, because unfortunately, the older we are at retirement, the less time we're going to be around.
The less life expectancy we have.
So it's done under a life expectancy chart developed by Congress. It's not your typical one you'd find in an IRS publication or the like. And at first glance, it appears to be a very long life expectancy, which some people say, well, they did that because the higher the number you divide into a number, the lower the number, the higher the taxable portion. I'm getting off on a tangent here. But
in that case, what happens if somebody dies before they've exceeded their life expectancy on that chart? So there's money left.
Goodness. Well, there's probably no money left. There is a tax deduction left.
Right.
So that if somebody had a 20-year life expectancy, died 10 years into it, survivor annuity or not, everybody's gone. The remaining half would then become a tax deduction all at once on the final year's return.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the issue, though. If the person died early in the year and there was this large amount to deduct, it's only deductible against the annuity benefit. So if the annuity benefit was small because they passed in February or March, they'd have a greater tax deduction than they would an annuity benefit. Can't have a negative number here
mm-hmm.
now.
Right.
So this is going to make people's hair hurt. The difference between that amount and what they're entitled to get becomes a miscellaneous itemized deduction. Now go figure that one. But that's the answer to the question. And so we go through this.
So it pays to die late in the year.
Yeah. So, you know, we have some health speakers and we would follow their advice and make sure we live till forever or at least until the end of the year. But then the next question is, well, you didn't say anything about cash. And this is where they get a little mad, but, you know, they understand it after you explain it. Cash is different. If somebody receives at least as much in annuity benefits as they had put into the system, there's no more cash coming if they die early.
Yeah, I always say that the definition of that lump sum contribution to retirement is different with the IRS than it is with OPM. Because the Office of Personnel Management looks at your contributions as, once we've paid you what you've put in, we're done. So like you said, there's no lump sum payment left for your beneficiary unless you die usually within 2 years of your retirement date. But for tax purposes, they use that chart that gives you this life expectancy beyond when most of us will live. So then there is a tax deduction left if you need one.
And they get very agitated with this. And they said, it's not really double taxation. If you look at it.
I went to court, back in 86?
Yeah, they did.
A friend of ours, Tom O'Rourke, I think, was in on that. He was a lawyer on that class action suit. And the government did make their point that it was a fair way to do it.
If it wasn't for the fact that IRS provides you the opportunity to claim it all, then I think there'd be a case. But IRS says, listen, okay, unfortunately lived a short period of time, we still will allow the deduction, mm-hmm. and it'll be a little convoluted, but here it is. The OPM just says, we promised you one thing at the day of retirement. We'll pay you at least as much as you put into the system.
Well, while we're on the topic of when you die, the other thing I would mention that people need to understand is that when somebody, let's say, passes away on the 25th of the month, their retirement check for those 25 days hasn't been paid yet. It's going to be paid on the first day of the following month. So you're saying, well, they're gone, so who gets their last check? Well, it's their beneficiary. So throughout your career, you've maintained beneficiary designations for retirement, for life insurance, for TSP, for unpaid compensation. So the one you've maintained for civil service or FERS retirement is going to determine who gets your last check. So when somebody's 90 years old, it's still important that they've maintained their beneficiary designation. Otherwise, it could end up being your ex-wife or ex-husband gets your last retirement check if you didn't change it.
Probably not a popular beneficiary for
those
that
survive. No, but I've seen it happen.
Yeah, I know. You talk about it a lot, so it must happen a lot.
It happens a lot. Yeah. Anybody who's worked in benefits has seen that situation happen. Even on 9/11, there were some cases that were adjudicated that you wondered, did they really mean for that person to get their life insurance or their thrift savings plan? But you probably figure that they just didn't update their beneficiary.
Ouch. Mm-hmm. Now, again, close to retirement, in one of the bullet points that we had on the website as to what we were going to talk about, and rather quickly, a quick final review of the voluntary contribution program. I guess we should first say CSRSers and CSRFs that only.
Right.
FERS people, don't listen to this because you will not be happy.
Yeah, well, voluntary contributions, the way I've been explaining it in class, I say that it's like a bank. If you have money and you want to invest money, you can put it in the bank and the bank's going to pay you interest and your money stays safe. Well, this is the same idea. If you have money you want to invest and you don't want to put it in the bank, you can put it in voluntary contributions where it will be safe and the government will pay you interest on it. But when you retire, that voluntary contribution account that you may have set up will stop earning interest. So then you have to decide what to do with it. And any growth, any interest that you've earned is almost like it's been in a CD, so it's been growing tax deferred. So you either have to withdraw the money, pay tax on the interest, or you can transfer the interest to your TSP account or to an IRA account, or you can even transfer the entire thing to an IRA, not to the TSP, but to an IRA so that it can continue to grow tax deferred. You just can't leave it in the voluntary contribution account. Otherwise, it will become an annuity. It will become part of your civil service retirement in a way that you may not want because you're going to lose access to the money.
Right.
So,
and of course, the transfer to an IRA could go directly to a Roth IRA. So
that's been the popular topic this year.
And it's a very hard topic. It's not hard to do anymore. OPM has come out and says, yes, it can go directly into a Roth. There was some discussion of this because the law changed in 2006 and had some other issues, but let's not deal with all the other issues with regards to tax law. But if the money goes directly to the Roth, the earnings would be taxable. But like you say, it could be transferred to the TSP or it could be transferred to a traditional IRA.
So you can split your account to say, I just want the principal to go to the Roth and I want the interest to go to the TSP or a traditional IRA.
All right.
But I think what you're saying is complicated is if you have other IRAs, right, besides just the voluntary contribution.
If you choose the direct route from the VC to the Roth, the prior IRAs really are not an issue. If you move the voluntary contribution into your traditional IRA and then into the Roth, you have something called the aggregation rules. And I just as soon not do that.
But that sounds complicated just by hearing it.
But they're all aggregated now. And inside of some people's traditional IRAs are fully taxable amounts. IRAs put in years ago, earnings, etc. So then you move the exact dollar amount from your voluntary contribution to your traditional and then the traditional to the Roth. Part of it becomes taxable because of these things called the aggregation rules. I sometimes affectionately call them the aggravation rules. But there's ways around that. You can transfer fully taxable earnings in an IRA into the TSP, which would leave the IRA at that point fully non-taxable, or just skip that and go directly to the Roth. And there's a fellow that I talk with fairly regularly in Newport News, Virginia, and he mailed up a draft IRS form that shows now that you can transfer the VC directly into a Roth. It doesn't say VC per name. They call it an employer's plan. Here's the rub. I sent this around. I was in euphoria. Finally, I got an answer. And then I sent it to a couple of tax attorneys and they go, well, okay, the voluntary contribution is a quote employer plan. Okay. But isn't the thrift? So would the aggregation rules apply to the thrift and the VC? And nobody's got an answer for that. Picture the headache that'd be.
Jeez.
Anyway, we'll keep.
So if you don't know, who would we go to get help with this?
I've gone to ERISA attorneys. I've gone to some of the sharpest people I know, and everyone, virtually to the person, says, we feel comfortable that you can do this. There's only one way to find out, and it's called a private letter rule. You can write a letter to the, you fill out a form to the IRS and say, this is my case, and could you give us your wisdom on this, whether this is appropriate or not? Here's the problem. It's not the cost. The cost, it's not inexpensive. It's expensive.
To do what?
To do this private riddle, but it has to be a real person. So who in their right mind is going to raise their hand and say, I've got this sticky situation and I want to do it. Tell me I can. And then you find out you can't. I haven't found nobody that wants to volunteer. I volunteer to pay for it.
But we do know people who are doing the voluntary contribution transfers to a Roth.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hoping they're doing it in the right way. So what's the worst that can happen?
Well, the worst that can happen is if, let's say you have, I'll use a lousy example, you have $10 in the voluntary contribution, multiply this by whatever you want, and you have $10 in the thrift. So combination two is 20. You move the 10 from the voluntary contribution directly into the thrift, and then you have to pay tax on five.
Mm-hmm.
That would be bad.
Yeah. Especially if it was.
And thus far, virtually everyone has said, no, that wouldn't be the case. But and I worry because somebody's going to come after me. So I'm
this is something that a lot of people have never done before. Very few people actually have voluntary contribution accounts. It's kind of a hidden secret in a way because a lot of agencies have never explained it to their employees. It's you come across it because you've read about it in an article or you've happened to have seen it on OPM's website. So I think it's something that's not as tested as we would like to see. But it is something, if you're in the category of someone who would have the money available to do this, I think it's something to certainly consider.
Yeah.
Nice place to set aside your money for the future growth.
Yeah, and remember, too, the voluntary contribution folks have to send a Form 1099 to the individual as well as the IRS.
Right.
But they don't really know what's in the thrift.
No.
So, you know, do they put
that
down fully taxable, non-taxable?
It so it,
there's a lot of sticky issues here, and it's not going to, I think, be clearly decided for a while. Now, let's bring our FERS folks in so that they don't feel left out. They still have the opportunity to move money from a traditional IRA into a Roth. Their concern, of course, would be if they move the traditional IRA money in, it might be non-taxable and it might be fully taxable, depending on when they put it in. But they always have the provision to transfer the taxable portion out of the traditional into the TSP, which would then leave just the non-taxable portion to go right on over to the Roth with no tax. Have professional guidance here because there's a timing issue, but I don't want to leave the FERS folks out because they, in class, if it's an all FERS class, we still have a fairly robust discussion of moving money into a Roth.
Right. I guess it depends on your age and how quickly you're going to be using the money to whether or not that even makes sense to do.
Very good.
So like you said, get some good advice before you think that that's the best thing to do with your money.
All right. Let's shine the spotlight a little bit more on the FERS folks. They have a three-legged stool, if you will, of retirement. And we talked about Social Security, but we didn't talk about the taxation of it. And many years ago, for some of us that might remember, Social Security was like, you didn't touch it. It was not taxable. And then they made it a little taxable, and they made it a little bit more taxable. It's still one of the best deals out there as far as the three-legged stool. The thrift is 100% taxable, of course. And the base FERS annuity is
almost
probably 90% taxable.
Yeah.
But Social Security, and this, again, is another one of these calculations that makes your hair hurt because everything spins off of one number on your return, your total income. But this gets into a little algebra, not that anybody asks you to do algebra, but it's not necessarily so easy. For a non-married individual, single, if their income is below $25,000, they don't pay tax whatsoever on their Social Security. If it's between $25,000 and $34,000, it's 50% taxable. This is not a 50% tax. It's, let's say you were getting $20,000 in Social Security. You'd have to report 10 on your return. 10 would be tax exempt. Now, if you look at that, that's a very favorable federal tax provision on a major piece of the FERS retirement. And in many states, not all, but in many states, Social Security is just non-taxable. So this is pretty nice. Now, if their income exceeds $34,000, then 85% of the Social Security is taxable. And I'd rather look at it the other way. 15% is non-taxable.
Yes, 15%
because people go 85%, 15% non-taxable. Still nice, and
yeah,
probably
some people misunderstand that, like you said, and think it's an 85% tax rate. And I'm like, no. It's 85% of it is going to be reported as taxable income.
Right.
15% of it's totally tax-free. Yeah, I always tell people at seminars, because they'll ask when we talk about Social Security, do you have to pay income tax on it? And I say, well, there's a lot of people who receive Social Security today that don't pay any income tax on it. But I said, it won't be you.
Yeah.
Because if you have other income like FERS retirement or CSRS retirement or TSP withdrawals, then you're probably going to push yourself into the bracket where you will be paying tax on at least some of your Social Security.
I cut it a little short, not to be short with him. I said, don't even talk about the first zero tax. You're not going to be
there. It's not going to be you.
Your base level of your annuity as well as some of the other, is just going to put you over.
Most people in our groups are probably going to be in that category where they pay tax on 85% of it.
Yeah. And again, they get mad. I said, well, you could always pay tax on 50% of it. And they said, that would be great. I said, no, it wouldn't.
It means you have a lot less income.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the one thing good about paying taxes. That means you have income to pay taxes on, which not everybody is so fortunate.
Yeah, that's true. And still, I get some looks like, get him out of the room.
I forget which Mark Twain or somebody said, you know, in a civilized society, taxes are the way we have nice things. You know, we have roads and schools. And so there's some benefit to paying taxes, I would think.
I always say that, and when we talk about it with accumulated leave at the end of the year, and you write these great articles each year in GovExec well before the end of the year about the best dates to retire, and really what you're saying in it is the best dates to be aware of not to retire, and it's very, very clear. But we talk about year-end, and people say, well, yeah, I have to pay tax on the accumulated leave. And I said, I have a guaranteed way to pay no tax whatsoever on your use-lose leave unless you're bracked. And they go, what's that? And I said, go out January 31st, February 1st, 2nd, or 3rd. And they go, well, then I wouldn't get the leave. And I said, you got the message. I think I'd rather get the leave and pay the tax.
Pay the tax on it. Like, yeah. Plus, it's a nice, if there is going to be that delay in getting the final processing of your retirement, you're still trying to decide what to do with your TSP account, it's nice to have that lump sum of money, even after tax money, that you can use to pay the bills and kind of buy yourself some time while you're really adjusting to those first couple of months of retirement. So I think a lot of people really appreciate having saved up some annual leave that they can cash in and have a little cushion as they transition from full career employment to those first months of retirement, that they get used to the difference in income and in the deciding of what they're going to do with their time and so forth.
And then the other thing with regards to Social Security, if you get it and you're going to pay taxes on it, then how do you pay the taxes? Do you increase the withholding on your base annuity? Well, actually, you can have federal taxes withheld from your Social Security check. Now, it's not the old, gee, how many exemptions do I claim? You pick a percent, whether it's 7% of your Social Security in total. They don't try to figure out the taxable portion, or 15% or 25%. So you can have it withheld so that it isn't so much of a burden to all come out of the annuity.
That's good. I was going to ask you that. I wasn't sure if you could do that or not. I think the only other thing withheld from a Social Security check would be Medicare Part B once you're 65. So there's very few withholdings. And a lot of people wonder, what are the withholdings from a retirement check from civil service or FERS? And just like you can have federal income tax withheld from your Social Security check, you can also have federal income tax withheld from your FERS or SERS retirement check along with insurance premiums. But what about state income tax? Will OPM withhold state income tax from a FERS or a SERS retirement check?
Well, it's again a good question. We spend, I won't say a fair amount of time, but you know, with the federal withholding, they hand you a W-4, and it's got a P next to it for pension, W-4P. Mm-hmm. And it's much like the W-4 we got years ago and said, what's an exemption? Well, we've learned what an exemption is over the years, but now we're going to get another one. So the withholding exemptions do not parallel what we had on the job and go automatically into retirement. We have to provide a form. However, let's say that somebody didn't give us a form, we didn't know to ask for a form, what would happen at the federal level? Well, it's a safety net that said if they don't get anything from you, you're going to get three exemptions, and it'll be based on marriage, whether you are or aren't, you will get married with three.
Okay.
And at least it's a safety net, because your comment is, what about state? Well, if you don't fill out a W-4 for the state that you want, you don't get anything withheld.
And in some cases, you don't need to, because there are some states that won't tax your federal retirement benefit, but you got to make sure you live in one of those states.
Yeah.
And if you don't live in one of those states, you have to make sure you tell OPM that you want state income tax withheld, because that's not an automatic withholding.
That's true. And they don't withhold for every state in the country. Now, they, you know, before people get unnerved about that, these are states that don't have many federal employees and
Wyoming.
Or retire. the Dakotas, et cetera. But generally, they will do it, but you have to provide the initiative. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing. If one moves from a state that they were retired in and having federal and state taxes withheld, and they move to a new state, whether it has taxes or whether it doesn't have taxes, unless you tell OPM to stop withholding
they don't know you
to
moved.
The state you move from, they don't stop.
No, and just because you've sent them a change of address form doesn't mean they're going to change your tax withholding. So
exactly.
You have to do all those changes. And same thing with health insurance. You know, if you live in a place where you have regional health care, like in HMOs like Kaiser or Aetna, make sure you also make the appropriate change to your health plan if it's not going to be serviceable in the new location. Because there are some states that don't even have an HMO. You know, South Carolina, Alaska, you won't find a federal HMO operating there, other than possibly Aetna in South Carolina, but very few.
Yeah.
So you got to switch back to Blue Cross or Samba or GEHA or one of the national plans.
Okay, let's take a look at repayment of TSP loans, because we got a great education, what, about 2 weeks ago from the fine folks at TSP?
Yeah, I learned some things there.
If somebody leaves federal service with a loan outstanding, and the classic case would be the worst case if somebody retired December 31st, and in theory, it should be taxable then, in theory. It's not in reality, mm-hmm. because at that point, they don't have any more salary checks other than the holdover check.
Yeah, you can't make loan payments out of your retirement checks. I think that's the key issue here, is that once you're retired, if you still owe, let's say you owe $10,000 on your loan balance of your TSP, you can't tell OPM to withhold those loan payments from your retirement check.
Right.
So then what?
So here we are. We retired with, like you say, a $10,000 loan. We don't have $10,000 sitting around in the sock drawer.
If you did, well, you could pay it off.
You could pay it off.
Just write a check and pay it back.
But, and I was very happy to hear this, a couple weeks after retirement, the thrift board sends to the individual, you owe us $10,000. You have 90 days to pay it.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to find the money in the sock drawer. Or better yet, you might even borrow it when you're considering the taxes and or maybe the penalties. And you can pay it off within the 90 days. Let's say that you don't pay it off within the 90 days. Then you have 60 days from that 90 days to put it into a traditional IRA, an amount equal to the loan balance in the thrift. So this could really carry on significantly, but the opportunities abound there.
Mm-hmm.
For somebody that might be a little cash tight, to give them the time to do it.
That buys them some more time to get it put away tax deferred,
yeah.
Whether they put it back in the thrift or they put it in an IRA.
And we had the director and Tom Tribuco of the TSP, two or 3 weeks ago?
It's at least 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. And we got on this discussion, and then we had some follow-up emails with the fine folks there, Penny Moran. And I got an education.
Yeah, I did too.
I didn't realize there was that much time. Anyway.
But if you don't do anything, then they're going to send you, is it a 1099?
It's a 1099. And again, let's say it was $10,000. It would show $10,000. And because it did come from the thrift, it's going to be 100% taxable.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be added to the income, not 1231, the year that they retired, the year that it became, if you will, a bad loan.
A distribution.
Yeah, a distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, they would have to pay taxes on it, and they may even have to pay a penalty on it, depending on their age.
Now, if they were under 55 when they retired or separated, then they would have to pay the penalty.
So it could be fairly costly. So that's why I say watch out for those dates, and if necessary, borrow the money, because you're talking about a combined federal, state, and a 10% penalty.
You could end up having half of it as tax due.
It wouldn't take much to lose a huge percentage of it.
Mm-mm. And it's money that you've probably already spent because you borrowed it, so you may not have it to pay it back. So you can get yourself into a little bit of a bind if you're leaving the federal service with an outstanding, especially if it's a significant balance on your loan. So be aware of that if you're planning to leave government service.
Yeah.
Yeah. Find a place to, and these days it's kind of hard to borrow money because banks are getting a little tighter with their loans.
Boy, aren't they.
So good luck on that one.
All right, TSP withdrawals, again, I think is more of a focus on the FERS folks, not that it's not important to the CSRSers, but when somebody leaves federal service at a normal retirement age, let's say, when do they have to start to take the money out?
They don't have to do anything when they first leave, and I think that's what a lot of people worry about. They're like, well, when do I fill out the form? What do I have to do? So even if you're over 70 and a half years old, you're not going to be required the month after you retire to put in the withdrawal form. So give yourself a little bit of time. Think it through. Decide if you're going to stay retired. You're going to go back to work. Do you really need the money? How much money do you need every month to make ends meet? And really think it through, because when you do make that withdrawal election, you're either going to do a partial withdrawal where you take some of the money out, leave the rest in for later, or you're going to do a full withdrawal where you can pick and choose among three basic withdrawal choices of purchasing an annuity, taking a stream of monthly payments, or taking some out in cash or transferring that cash payment to an IRA. So you can mix and match. You can say, well, I need $1,000 a month to pay my bills, so I can take a check every month for $1,000 a month, or maybe split that up as an annuity payment for $500 and the other $500 in cash. Then with the remainder of the money, I can transfer that to an IRA so I'd have it available for later use. You know, if I want to take a chunk out to put a new roof on the house or take a cruise, I have it available. So I haven't locked it all up in the annuity or even the monthly payment stream.
What you say is very important, because the thrift, while a fine organization and a fine tool, is very inflexible as far as taking distribution when one wants to. Like you say, you set up a series of payments, but you can't just go in and say, gee, I need something to fix my house.
Right. You can only change the amount once a year if you do the payment stream.
And that's the better of the two, isn't it? There's two monthly payment streams. One is based on a life expectancy, but it's a mechanical calculation that one has no control over. Or the other one, like you say, where you tell them what you want, but you can change your mind every year. So you could keep it very low if you wanted to. And then in times of need, you could increase it to fix that roof or maybe buy that car and pay it off.
One thing I do like about the life expectancy payout option is that every year that goes by, of course, your life expectancy changes, plus the earnings or losses in your account will change. So each year that goes by, the amount of that monthly payment is going to change, hopefully go up and increase. But if you had a bad year like 2008, your payment would be adjusted lower to reflect the fact you have a smaller balance. So I think in the life expectancy payout option, at least the way I see it, you would have less chance of depleting the balance before you're depleted. So, you know, as the payment changes and adjusts from year to year, it's compensating for growth and losses and your age. So that as time goes by, you hopefully can offset inflation by having those payments increase.
As we say in class, under that option, we call it the A option, you know one thing, you're going to get a monthly payment for life. What you don't know is, how much is it going to be?
Right.
So under the B option, you can get whatever you want, but you don't know how long the money is going to last.
That's right. You could take too much out early, and then you end up with a dry fund.
Yeah.
Which could be scary.
And I think, I believe you educated me that if you were on the first one where it was a life spread, you can stop it and move it into the discretionary fund where you're in control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have one time opportunity. If you want to switch it from life expectancy payment back to kind of a self-directed payment, you can do that.
Right.
But you can't go back and forth every year.
And the self-directed one, I think I actually like better, because you can make it look like the life spread, but you're not stuck with it.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah,
I had an email just this weekend, and somebody wrote to me, and he said, I decided I'm going to take my TSP as a life annuity. I forget what the question. The question wasn't, is that a good idea? The question had something to do with, I forget what it was, something about the interest rate. But what I wanted to point out to him was, make sure you understand what a life annuity is. Because once you've purchased the life annuity, which is not the same as the stream of monthly payments we were just talking about, the life annuity is where you make a contract between you and an insurance company that you give them your money in exchange for a stream of payments over your entire lifetime, which that's a nice, secure promise that you get a check every month as long as you live. But now you no longer have access to your money. And if you lock in the current interest rate, which is 3.125%, and 5 years from now, the interest rate goes up to 6%. Too bad, you've locked in 3.125 for the rest of your life. So be sure that's what you really want, because right now interest rates on everything are low and annuities are no exception. So you'd be locking in a very low interest rate.
MetLife annuity through the thrift is certainly good. And people say, why do I have to do MetLife? Well, you don't have to do MetLife if you have some predisposed negativity towards MetLife. And there's nothing wrong with MetLife, but some people
The TSP chose them because of their size.
Because they're so good.
Well, and plus they can handle the volume of business that they potentially might get from TSP investors.
But they could, if they really didn't want to do the MetLife annuity, they could transfer the money into a traditional IRA and then buy the annuity via the IRA with whatever else they might feel to be better. The other point is, like you say, Tammy, today's interest rates aren't tomorrow's interest rates. Now, who knows whether we're going to have deflation, inflation. If we did, we probably wouldn't be doing
or stagnation.
All right. Or stagflation. But I'm reminded, this is about 11 years ago. I'll do this very fast. Individual engineer, retired, said, I'm going to buy the MetLife annuity. Engineers are generally very good managing their money. This person was no exception. I said, why would you do that? It only pays about 7.3% interest. So it explains why I'm not a financial planner. And this person, fortunately, is still alive.
What we wouldn't do to get that. It hasn't been that high since the time people only had $2,000 in their thrift.
So this person was very very astute with money. Okay, real fast. We have 2 minutes. When do we apply for Social Security? That's a whole show, isn't it?
Not really. Actually, Social Security has become very automated, and it's electronic, and it's very simple to do. I think where Social Security gets its bad nickname is on the disability side, because you have to have that approved through an administrative judge. But to apply for Social Security retirement, you can now go online, ssa.gov or socialsecurity.gov, or you can call the 800 number, or you still have your local Social Security office, but I would recommend starting online or over the phone and then make an appointment to visit your local office and do the final application. Especially if you're CSRS, you want to find out how your retirement might affect your Social Security benefit that you're either receiving already or that you're potentially going to receive because of the windfall and the offset. If you're FERS, you want to understand what to really expect from Social Security and how much income you're going to get to replace what you're making as you're working. So there's some planning to do there, too. And SSA.gov is a wonderful place to start.
Okay, boy.
Try to squeeze that all in 1 minute.
You did great. Well, that's what we got. We got 1 minute. Final comments, Tammy?
Well, I just think people need to take responsibility and not count on your agency doing it all for you. You know, understand your benefits, go to a seminar, get an estimate so that you know what you're getting into when you retire.
Great. And know your tax structure and the real cash flow that you're going to have to make your ends meet.
Or hire someone to help you if you're not sure.
All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week. I'm not so sure about next week, but it's the hospice folks and you and Ann, I believe, we're going to be
on. We're going to cover something we haven't covered before.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Wake up and drive in with Tom Tamman and Amy Morris on the Federal Drive. It's your early line on the day ahead from your trusted advisors. Tom and Amy give you a full view of the issues. Find out what your colleagues in other agencies are up to